Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 192, Living Forward and Giving Back, with Isabel St. Jean. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I remember we were creating music in the big hallway of a hospital, and we started to dance, and some of the doctors and nurses joined in with us, and all of a sudden there was that sense of, wow, all the barriers of roles and differences had fallen away, and here we were in the circle of joy and music, connecting together, and it was so moving.
That was the voice of my guest, Isabel St. Jean. Isabel St. Jean is a certified NLP practitioner, professional life transitions coach, and certified retirement coach with a background including decades of personal development and a degree in social work and psychology. Following graduate studies in authentic leadership at Naropa University in Boulder, Isabel initiated and co-authored the award-winning anthology Einstein's Business, Engaging Soul, Imagination, and Excellence in the Workplace. Pursuing her interests in human development and the midlife journey at this pivotal point of our evolution on Earth, Isabel has authored the new book, Living Forward, Giving Back, A Practical Guide to Fulfillment in Midlife and Beyond. She's also a contributing editor to the forthcoming anthology, Audacious Aging, Eldership as a Revolutionary Endeavor, which further supports boomers and elders to live full on as they lead and or participate in the necessary ongoing transformation of our world. Through her company, Inspired Momentum Development, Isabel offers keynote presentations, seminars, workshops, and one-on-one coaching services that help people to negotiate life transitions, align with their purpose to embrace their authentic vocation and passions, and make a difference in the lives of others. You may visit her website at www.inspiredmomentum.com. Now, here's the interview. Isabel St. Jean, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Hello, David.
Hello. Our mutual friend, Larry Robinson, who was a guest back on Shrink Wrap Radio number 6, we're way up on your number 192. He was number 6. He loaned me your book, suggesting you'd make a good guest. And having spent some time with your book, I'd have to say that was an excellent recommendation.
Great to hear that. <Thank you.
laughs> So what led you to write this book?
Well, it was really quite a journey, David. I think it was... It seemed to be a bit of a convergence point, if I may say, around... You know, it's an accumulation of personal development that I had done by that time for probably over 3 decades. Also, if I think about some of the seeds of activism and leadership that were planted throughout my life, some of them started to show up as a teenager when I was doing some activities in my high school, for example. Thinking back also at the time when the decision gelled in my mind and my heart, I realized that I was being coached by a very empowering person who had a way of drawing out and helping me align with my truth, my wisdom, and a sense of engagement.
How wonderful.
As well, yes, and I would add also that some of the people that have influenced me over the past few years include people like Patch Adams, that I had the opportunity to meet, as well as Parker Palmer. One of the things that Parker Palmer said to me that I found very moving is when he was talking about the Rosa Parks decision. And it, I think my decision to create my book, to write my book, was a little bit like a Rosa Parks decision. What he means by that is kind of like a moment of existential courage, and combined with the power of the human heart, you know. And I have a little quote from a talk that he did where he said, it's like when you are ready to take a stance, when you know that no externally imposed punishment could be greater than conspiring in your own diminishment of not honoring your own truth. So through this book, I'm honoring my truth and the wisdom and the truth and the experience of others who have contributed their stories, as well as synthesizing where I think we are at, the boomers generation at this time on our planet.
Yes, well, a lot of the things that you say really come through in the book. You say that it's rooted in your life, and it has to do with speaking your own truth that's come through the 30 years of personal exploration and development. And it really comes through that way as it reads like a very spontaneous unfolding of, as you say, your truth, without being preachy and without setting yourself up as some sort of a guru. So I really like that quality of the book. It's very strong and straightforward. Now, who did you have in mind as your reader?
Ah, well, it is the most definitely the boomer generation that I'm right in the middle of. I'm 53 years old, actually, and as we know, the boomers are the generation that were born between 65 and 46, following the Second World War, as we know. And so it was the sense that many of us are about to embark in a few years, or some of us are also getting into some form of retirement, and the sense that retirement is a concept that I felt was, and more and more people feel that is actually obsolete, and that what's needed is a sense of re-engagement. So that is a concept that is explored in depth in various places in my book, as you probably noticed, David.
Yes. Yes, you know, you're talking about the boomers and about fulfillment in midlife, and yet I think what you have to say would be of interest pretty much to everybody. And I found I didn't want to put midlife in the title of this podcast for fear that it might cause younger listeners to skip it.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a good point, actually, David. A friend of mine is just in her mid-30s, and she said, she confessed to me that she was a little tired that day. She said, I was reading your book last night and I couldn't put it down. So, yes, most definitely it does address a lot of points that defy the boundaries of gender and age. So thank you for mentioning that.
Yes.
That's very much true.
Yeah.
Yes.
And another thing that I noticed is that your book is full of beautiful quotes. Just out of curiosity, how do you gather and keep track of the quotes you like? I've never taken the time to set up a system.
Ah, well, I do read a lot. I expose myself to many books and quote. And in fact, actually, I have a binder of quotations that I found at some point. They had been compiled in an e-book, and so that is something that I refer to from time to time, as well as whenever I come across a quotation that really inspires me, of course, I write it down. And I wouldn't say I have a very well-organized system, but I do have a basis of where I have a binder in which I accumulate them. That's one of the ways that I keep track of the good ones.
Yeah, did you start collecting them before the book?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Because I know sometimes when you begin a project, then things synchronistically, you know, magically appear, the exact things that you're looking for.
Absolutely. And this occurred throughout the whole 3 years that I was writing. You know, I would be living inside of a particular question for some time and then find some answers appearing, and they're from various sources. So, yes, that's very true. That does happen.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the quotes, for example, on page 20, you have the following quote from Einstein, and I'll go ahead and I'll read it. Your quote, your quote from Einstein says, "A human, let me start it again. A human being is part of a whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty." I was surprised to read such a Buddhist-sounding outlook by Einstein.
Yes, that's a good point. Well, and the essence of that quote is very much in line with the concept of generativity that I wanted to give a special place, and hence I wrote a whole chapter called that's titled "The Call of Generativity," as you know. I think that this is probably that Einstein wrote this. I imagine that it was very likely to be in the midst of his life or in midlife, where that sense of wanting to expand our caring, our compassion to those beyond our immediate closer circles is an urge, and it's a force that really comes through when we listen in, when we are engaged in the process of intentionally developing our consciousness. And so, yes, I love that. I'm wondering what in particular, if I may ask back there, what made this quotation stand out to you? And you can answer with a question to me, perhaps.
Uh-oh, you're turning the table around on me.
I'm having a conversation with you.
Yeah, okay. I was struck, I think, by his talking about the delusion of separateness. And that's the part that kind of struck that sort of Buddhist association for me, that delusion or illusion that we are separate. And of course, more and more these days, I think increasingly we are aware of the interconnectedness of all things in a way that, you know, even science supports this idea now.
Absolutely. Well, in fact, this is you're referring to, and the quote was in the chapter where I talk about what I call the visionary leaders of our past, Einstein being among them, as well as Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and people like even John Lennon, who had an incredible sense of vision for what happens if we were to imagine a better world, and Mother Teresa, of course. And out of when I spoke about some of these leaders and how their life exemplified certain universal truths, I distilled three of what I think of timeless truths from their life, and those are, as a matter of fact, the interdependence, the interconnectedness that we all share, as well as the power of unconditional love, and that has to do with the essence of the human heart, especially when it's combined in synergy with the power of our mind. As well as the truth that commitment, the power of commitment, is also a force that enables us to move mountains, you know. one of my favorite quotes that is well known is the one from Goethe, who said that when we really commit, Providence moves with us. And that refers back to the synchronicity you were talking about a moment ago. And also, when you were saying a moment ago that science has even really affirmed more and more that we are indeed all interconnected, I was thinking back of Rupert Sheldrake.
Oh, yes.
And I pulled out this book I have on my shelf that I read over 20 years ago, A New Science of Life, and I noticed that this was written in 1981 when he talked about the morphogenic fields as one of the discoveries of what makes us all interconnected on so many levels.
Yes, I like that you mentioned that quote by Goethe as well, supporting synchronicity. That one leapt out at me, because he wrote that considerably before Jung ever talked about synchronicity, or before there was, you know, The Secret and all these other ideas that if you really focus on something and, quotes, put it out to the universe, that the universe is likely to be responsive.
Yes, very much so. The sense of commitment to me has evolved for me, actually, and I've gotten insights even recently. It seems to be a deepening and, you know, a kind of experience in which I started noticing more and more that as I really embody a sense of commitment into something that is really close to my heart. One of which, for example, these days is about bringing my book in the world and honoring its message and giving it some wings, that I find that when I give myself into something that's bigger than myself, then there is that sense of reciprocity with life, you know, that sense of flow that occurs when I devote my energies and my heart into something.
Yes. Now, in chapter one, especially, you explore the challenges and opportunities of our generation, or of the boomers. Actually, I'm a little bit older than the boomers as a whole. And you conclude this chapter with your observation of six new positive trends. Take us through those trends, if you will.
Sure, yes. Well, one of the first one that I saw emerging, and that was in the course of completing an anthology that was called Einstein's Business, Engaging Soul, Imagination, and Excellence in the Workplace. I initiated this project with the publisher and co-editor, Dawson Church in California.
Yes, I've interviewed him, as a matter of fact.
Ah, great, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, we had a wonderful time doing this project together, and this is a project that enabled us to have many people generating their knowledge, their wisdom, and it was a wonderful. And one of the things that I became more acutely aware of around that time is the fact that the concept of the triple bottom line is taking hold more and more, you know, that it's not just about the profits, but the social responsibilities and the sustainable practices that corporations are wanting to commit to more and more, although we've heard that recently with the economic downturn that there might be some rethinking around that. Hopefully that won't be and the case to a far extent, but I think we have a good momentum that way, that the triple bottom line is getting to be more and more something that is honored and seen as important at this crucial time. A second one is what I refer to Margaret Wheatley, who is a speaker, author, and consultant, and she said, I love how she mentioned the phrase "turning to one another" as something that we need to do more than ever before. And so I think that there's definitely that sense of movement that we are craving to turn to one another, and we certainly need to keep doing that more and more, especially with the challenging times economically. And I guess, for example, the fact that if you look at the internet site meetup.com, it shows that there are a huge number of people that are meeting around thousands of different interests Doing that also helps us to not only connect, of course, but it helps to counteract the sense of isolation that we can have sometimes when we spend too much time behind our computers.
Yes, I know about that.
Yes. And so another one is the fact that when we do meet up together and share our interests and our passion and a sense of engagement, what seems to happen more and more is that groups are formed that are taking up all sorts of causes for things that really matter. You know, when we think about social issues, the environment, and there was a book that was created around that sense of movement, and you might know Blessed Unrest by Paul Hawkins, where half of his book is actually a listing of the huge amount of organizations that have developed around various social issues, environmental issues, and that people more and more are wanting to come together in compassion, put their compassion in action together, and honor, having a sense of reverence for nature, affirming values of social justice, etc. A fourth development that I talk about is the generativity. That's that inner force, that fire in the belly I was talking about, that really seems to peak around midlife, if we're talking about, especially there's a turning point around when 50, the early 50s come. I think that's been my observation, that this sense of wanting to expand one's consciousness, to reach others, to give, to serve, to make a difference, becomes very prominent at that time for a lot of people. And the fifth one is also the fact that, and there's a biological basis for this that I refer to in my book, around the brain hemisphere connecting better, as we found from neuroscience, that there are layers of myelin sheathing that help the two hemispheres of our brain becoming better connected, and that goes on till we reach our early 50s. And it seemed that all of a sudden there's a kind of blossoming of creativity that seemed to occur in a lot of people around that age range. That's something I've noticed, and I think that, of course, creativity is so needed in our time when we have to really dig deep and a lot of the innovate so that we can find solutions to the very big challenge we're facing. The last one, the sixth positive trend that I thought about is the fact that many people are entering eldership and some form of retirement, but more and more the people in this generation are wanting to do something different. There's no longer a sense that retirement should be a life of leisure. And so the boomers will be re-engaging, rather, with a sense of balance, ensuring that they have joy in their life, as well as that that they're contributing to the betterment of our world, that they are giving their love, their creativity, etc. That seems to be something that's taking hold more and more in that sort of quest that the boomers are on, and that they are wanting to retire or re-engage rather than retire, actually.
Yeah, following up on that last point there, you talk about countering the myths of midlife, and here you're using myth in the sense of misconception or falsehood. What do you see as the misconceptions about midlife, and what do you suggest as a way of shifting this paradigm?
The sense of crisis, that's probably the term that we hear most often associated with midlife as a crisis. But I think it's a crisis to the extent that it seems that what happens is we've lived to that point with certain assumptions about what would really make us happy. You know, the American dream, for example, the conventional one I'm thinking of, you know, that it's about having money and lots of money and status and a lot of material things that will make you the envy of everyone.
Right.
You know, that side of the American dream is what happens is that lots of people then come to midlife and realize, wait a minute, that is not what makes me happy. In my coaching practice, I've seen people, I have examples in my book of someone that I had coached who was a successful lawyer in midlife and who had all the conventional success and found that he wasn't happy. And so there's a reassessment of what really matters to me. And a recognition that what matters is different in our 50s as, of course, 20s and 30s. And so I've identified in the midst of my research what I call seven developmental opportunities that come on our trajectory in midlife. I can name those if you like.
Yes, I do.
Okay, and they are explained, of course, in depth throughout my book. But here, I'll say what I sense they are. And the first one is quite evident to a lot of us, is to simply reconnect with and listen to our authentic self. What is the authentic essence that resides within us? At the spiritual level, and how does that manifest in the world when we are in physical form? Slowing down enough so that we can enjoy our life, because of course the breakneck speed doesn't enable us to really quench our thirst for joy that we have deep in our soul. And so it becomes more of an urge also to enjoy our life because we become so acutely aware of the fact that our life is precious but also precarious, because by the time we get to midlife, we have heard of people who have had sudden illness. All of a sudden, they're no longer with us, and so we become much more aware of our mortality. A third one is to express ourselves. That is also, again, an urge that comes with the creativity. We want to free our voice. We want to free our wisdom. And also, I think that urge to free our voice comes as a desire to gain more clarity about who we really are at that time, at that pivotal point in our life. And reassessing our purpose and realigning with our values with integrity, which is the fourth one I've named, comes along with that self-expression, the conversations we have with others, the exchange, the communication back and forth, all of that helps us to come to clarity. Connecting more deeply with those we love and develop new relationships that can enable us to see ourselves in a new light. Often you'll find people in midlife, you know, the classic businessman that realizes that perhaps their child is about to become a teenager, and the father might realize, wait a minute, I hardly know this child. What happened here? I was so busy with my business life that I didn't get a chance to really get to know my child. And there might be a sense of wanting to connect deeply, wanting to delve more into our personal lives to balance it, to not put so much attention into the business world, the work life that might have called us very intensely in our in the earlier parts of our life. But in midlife, we sense that we want more connection with the people close to us. And as well, because we tend to see ourselves through the eyes of others, in new relationships, new friendships enable us to see ourselves where we are today without being entrapped by sometimes we can end up feeling that we're entrapped by the vision or the perception that people had from us when they first knew us 15, 20, or 30 years ago, and that if they don't have the ability to grow with us, to see how we grow ourselves, if they're not on a growth path themselves, then they may not be able to honor who we are and who we are becoming as we flourish from the inside out. Simplifying our life is also another urge, and it's very important now, as we know, because we cannot keep consuming so much and depleting our resources. So there is a sense that we want to simplify our life also because less energy then go into acquiring and maintaining material things. Also because their importance diminishes as we go on in our life. And the last one that I've mentioned here refers to that sense of generativity, that we want to harness that force and figure out how we're going to make our life matter, how we're going to make a difference. Maybe we might move towards a cause that calls us, or it could be this could be achieved in all sorts of different ways to give our energy, our attention to things that we resonate with, that we feel are important.
Speaking of things that are important, I know that Bali is important to you. I gather that you've been there several times, and you refer to it numerous times in your life in the book. What can you tell us about your love of Bali and its people and how it's influenced your life?
Ah, yes. Well, the first time that I went there was in 2004 for an event that was called Quest for Global Healing, where we had wonderful speakers and activists, spiritual activists. Desmond Tutu was one of the people among them that I found to be very wonderful and inspiring, of course, to say the least. But also mingling in the midst of people that were from many different countries. I loved the experience, but also I loved something. What I noticed in Bali when I first arrived there was the middle of the night, and of course I was very tired. It was such a long journey from Vancouver. But the next day I opened the beautifully carved door of the room that I was in a little cottage, this hotel, and I looked outside and I just felt, my first thought was, this is a place where I can just be. Somehow, in this culture, I got a sense that I could be a human being again, as opposed to being a human doing, which is what I'd felt compelled to become in my culture, in the Western world. So that was part of the experience, as well as getting to know some people, and I developed some friendship there, with Balinese people that have become so special. It's basically a sense of having an extended family all the way across the planet. And the sense of, when we're talking about interconnectedness, is very strong in the Balinese people, how much they care for one another, and their spirituality that they live so beautifully in everyday life. That is also another strength and another part of their inner richness I love.
Yes, near the end of your book, you share your own experience of giving by making a Balinese person's dream come true. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yes, well, and this is one of the friends that I made in that first time that I went to Bali, and so then this was a young man in his late 20s who came to the hotel lobby, and he just loved to have conversations with people. He had a pretty good mastery of English, and I could see that he had a sharp intellect and a hunger for learning and conversation and a beautiful sense of his spirituality. And so we stayed in conversation, we exchanged email, and after I left, I offered to pay for some course that he wanted to take to contribute to his education and his development. And so when I came back a year and a half later for another round of the conference, Quest for Global Healing, he greeted me, and one of the moments in which we were together is that he showed me all the certificates of the course that he had taken, and he had so much pride, and he had gifts for my children, and I was just so moved by the depth of his gratitude. And I remember saying, "Oh, that's almost too much, Sanctu." And he said, "Oh, that's what you gave me will last me my whole life." And I thought, "Wow, it seems to be so little." That I had given him the opportunity to take some courses locally. And so then I started thinking about, well, you know, this is one of the things about when we sense gratitude, we want to give more. That was the reaction I had. And so we deepened our friendships, our friendship that second time, and then I had the idea that a few months before going there for a third time, which was last year, to make arrangement to have him come here, and I wanted to sponsor him and host him, for him to come for 1 month to attend our local university, where there's a wonderful program for foreign students. And so I made the arrangement with the help of some of my friends. I did a little micro fundraising, and so that he was able to come back with me in August here last year. And it was such an amazing experience for him. He'd been dreaming of going overseas for decades, probably ever since he was a young person, and to have an experience of our culture. And at the same time, you know, it made him realize all of the good aspects of his culture, how people are so bonded together, and which he noticed that, well, at least in Vancouver, it's not quite so easy to connect with people and make friends. And so he got to see that, yes, it seems that we have a lot here in the material world, but he also got to appreciate what his culture has to offer in terms of the depth of relationships, connectedness, and richness.
Yes, themes of giving and gratitude run through the book. You give lots of examples of other people who further on in their life kind of discovered the importance of giving instead of focusing so much on acquiring. And I know in your book you discussed in relation to retirement something called Freedom 55, the idea that financial planners get people to invest and save so they can be free from the work at 55. But you make the point that real freedom is not about having loads of savings or investments, but rather what?
Well, it's an internal sense of being able to choose how we respond to what occurs in our lives. And in that chapter, I refer to the book that was written by this psychiatrist who had experienced concentration camp. His name escapes me.
Is it Viktor Frankl?
Yes, exactly. That's right. He had an amazing opportunity to see how people react when they are exposed to extreme hardship, of course. And noticing that there were a few who would still be able to preserve a sense of dignity because they had the ability to choose how they responded to what was going on the outside. And so there's the sense that investing in our inner life gives us so much more moral fiber, if you will, to weather some of the difficulties we may experience. And we know that, that there are challenging times upon us with the economic difficulties that are being experienced in our culture. And so to have that sense of inner freedom, to know that we can choose how we react, how we respond to what occurs around us, is really actually the ultimate freedom. I give an example also of the fact that it's amazing to when I hear about stories such as one that I share, where Lindquist was saying that she had gone to a party in New York where she presented a talk about some of her involvement in Africa, fundraising to help end hunger many years ago, and that a fellow approached her at the end and said, you know, I'm a billionaire, and he said, it occurred to me for the first time in my life tonight that I have enough money, and now I want to get into philanthropy. She found that amazing, and what I thought was amazing about that was thinking that, well, what happened while he was a millionaire? Did it not occur to him then that he did have enough, that he could give back in some way? And so I heard also recently from a woman who was a financial advisor. She said, well, one client I'm working with, he says he has a few million accumulated, but his goal is to have 15 million because somehow he thinks that once he has 15 million, then he'll be really comfortable and he'll be feeling free. Well, so here's the irony. This is where it really shows that feeling free is not about how many millions you've accumulated. It happens from the inside. It's a journey.
Yes, yes. You know, and you've made reference a couple of times to the challenging economic times that we're in right now. And I think there have been hints of this throughout the discussion, but what would you see as the ways that the either practices or attitudes that will help people to come through this time?
Yes. Well, one of the things that I think perhaps it seems to be occurring more and more, that's probably instinctual, is to look at how we spend our money, and perhaps consider to invest our money, voting with our money, in other words, putting money behind what really is important. And so there are so many different ways of doing that, but you know, one practice could be even to take a good look at where our money is being spent and reassess whether that really is matching with our values that we hold, and in consideration also the fact that our values change over time. Another thing I think about, or I suggest to people, is to reconsider the money as an exchange for goods and services. And what's come to my attention around that is that there are certain companies that are involved in bringing out the concept of bartering again as
yes.
a viable option. For example, I've noticed in an article recently the company called Green Apple Barter that was quoted to have arranged more than $500 million in trade among 5,000 companies since 1991. So that's maybe another way of exchanging goods and services that we need to think about more and more. And, of course, investing for the long term, choosing wisely. I have in my book I have a story of a man named Carsten Henningsen who developed a company of investment that are socially responsible and environmentally sensitive, responsive investment. And he was one of the pioneers in that field, and his company has grown immensely. He is one of the resources that I have at the end of my book. I think that's really important. Another thing I mentioned, too, is that if we are experiencing hardship in our finances, that if we worry too much about it, it's kind of like the equivalent of if you're in deep water and all of a sudden you're struggling to try to not to prevent yourself from drowning, you could end up drowning just from the fact that you're struggling mindlessly. Whereas if you decide to relax about it, and if you were in the water, for example, go on your back and float and direct yourself to where you're needing to be, to come to a sense of financial security, if you will, or a more healthy financial situation. Well, that's what we know, is that worries do not help anything. And of course, when we talk about, you referred to synchronicity before and the power of our mind. If we put our focus, we know that we tend to attract what we focus on, and if we put our focus on the lack of what it is we're wanting, chances are that that's what will be more reflected in our life, is the lack, as opposed to if we put our focus on what we have, the appreciation of it becomes stronger, enhanced, and as well as focusing on whatever little improvement may be occurring in our life, also brings on more of that sense of improvement, that we are restoring a sense of balance and health in our finances.
Okay, thank you. So, you know, part of what I get from this is that there may be a silver lining in terms of the challenges of the time may throw us back on opportunities for spiritual and personal growth and development and renewed connection with others, gratitude for what we have, and also supporting one another.
Absolutely. And just to give you a little example in everyday life of when we're talking about more appreciation, I recall one of my coaching clients who said, well, you know, we have a little bit less disposable income, and so we go out for dinner just, you know, once or twice a month instead of every week. And then he said, we just notice how we appreciate it so much more when we do. And so, yeah, this is the kind of opportunity to look at our lives and see that there might be so many things that we take it for granted that we have no enjoyment of them anymore. And so, in the course of reassessing and choosing again, then we have a chance to experience more appreciation, more enjoyment for what we are doing.
Yeah, you know, speaking of lifestyle, later on in the book, you've got a chapter on lifestyle and ways to travel, and you share a story there about joining a clowning tour in Italy. Can you recount that for us?
Oh, yes, yes. That was part of the lovely influence of Patch Adams, the clown doctor that a very well-known movie was made about. And I had the opportunity to meet him when he came to Vancouver, and I was very much moved by his essential message about compassion and love, of making love a priority in our world. And so I joined this, I got on his mailing list, and the opportunity came to join a group of about 20 people in Italy. That was in July of 2005, I believe, and there were people from about 7 different countries. And so we went to various hospitals, we went to what was called mental health communities, and foster homes, and environments where people were so happy to welcome us, and we connected with them in joy and compassion and friendship. I remember a particular moment when there was an older man, and he was, I believe, perhaps in his last days, he was on palliative care of a hospital, and he greeted us, and his wife was standing by his bed, and he said he's one of his things, he's always wanted to kiss beautiful women, and so he asked us if he could kiss us, and we gave him a little kiss, and he was just glowing. You know, he came alive, and he was just so lovely in this sense of, I think he was going to have a beautiful death because there was a sense of contentment about him and appreciating simple joy all the way to the last moment. I also remember going to a gathering that was organized for us where we came outside, and it was an event outside, and we created a lot of music, and we started to dance with a group of teenagers, who most of whom had Down syndrome. And I remember seeing a girl who was looking at us from standing on the edge of our circle and being shy. And then as time went on in this gathering, she started merging with us and coming out and started dancing. And then the more we gave her some of our attention and our love and our caring, I just saw her blossoming. And there was a moment where I thought, oh, she was glowing. And I thought, wow, there she is. She has freed herself into exuberance. And it was just so lovely to see. Another moment where I remember we were creating music in the big hallway of a hospital, and we started to dance, and some of the doctors and nurses joined in with us, and all of a sudden there was that sense of, wow, all the barriers of roles and differences had fallen away, and here we were in the circle of joy and music, connecting together, and it was so moving. These are little examples of delightful moments on this trip. And at the end, there was another great moment when I remember receiving an email, actually two weeks after my return, where the tour leader, Ginevra, said that she'd had feedback from some of the doctors in the hospitals, and they said some of them had reported that we had shifted the atmosphere in the hospital. And so that was just a wonderful thing to know, that we had made that difference.
It made you feel wealthy, right?
Absolutely, yes. There's one more thing, a little quick thing I wanted to add, is that while some of the doctors really appreciated our time there and welcomed us, there were a few that I remember encountering who were quite serious and didn't seem to really have that sense of openness when they met us. And I remember saying to another clown as we were coming out of the hospital, did you see this person? He was so serious. And he was dead serious. And then it occurred to me that being dead serious would not be conducive to healing, which is what is supposed to be occurring in hospitals.
Yes, it could lead to being seriously dead.
That's right. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in those little expressions that we have, and that was one of them that really stood out for me, how important it is to not be dead serious around people that are trying to recover.
Yeah, good point. Now, as we begin to wrap up here, you do coaching with people in midlife. Tell us a bit about your practice, how you got into it, what your sessions are like, how people find you.
Well, it seems that most people find me on the internet, and also word of mouth is occurring as well. You know, my background is in social work and family counseling, and in midlife I had a call to reinvent myself, like many people, and so I left the job I had in social work and retrained as an NLP, with the NLP-based program, neuro-linguistic programming. That was over 5 years ago. So I've developed my practice gradually based on NLP, but also adding many other tools and skills. And really, it's a process. My coaching practice revolves around what I call life transitions. So I have people sometimes, even in their 20s, coming to me with a quest for tapping into what is an authentic vocation for them. So that is one example of where I help people. But also in midlife, that urge to reinvent oneself that is so common. Basically what seems to happen in the coaching process is that there's an energy field that's created in which people come to clarity. about what matters, their values, what they're wanting to be, do, have, contribute to the world. And that clarity is so important, because otherwise when we feel confused or inwardly divided, it's kind of like what we call psychological reversal. You know, that's like when your batteries are in backwards.
Yeah.
It's like it doesn't go anywhere. That's, you know, you'll have people saying, well, I want to do this, but there's two opposing forces within people often that prevent them from moving forward, because these two forces are canceling each other out, and so then you have status quo, and the risk is that people will awaken 10 years later and think, oh my God, I've missed an opportunity here. I was kind of asleep at the wheel of my life. So I'm helping people to make sure that doesn't happen to them, to go in and harness their inner resource, their wisdom, harvest the learning from their life experience, and envision what it is that they're wanting to create with their life, how they want to shape it. So I give them tools. It's a very empowering process, because from the clarity, the tools that people acquire, the strengths that they get to harness to direct themselves into shaping their life into something that will make their heart sing. We talk about flow states also, how to have an experience of flow states. You know, that's when your life feels that it's coming together. There's a sense of congruence. You're flowing with the universe. The synchronicity is flowing. And so all of that serves to deeply improve the quality, the richness, and the meaning of our lives.
Well, that sounds absolutely wonderful. So,
yes.
So winding up here, is there anything else you'd like to leave our audience with?
Let's see. Perhaps, if I may, in closing, share just the last few sentences that are the very closing part of my book.
Yes.
Because that encapsulates a little bit of a call for our generation especially. And so here's where the last few sentences where I'm saying, more and more, in spite of our present social, economic, and global ecological crisis, we must hold our vision of a new world and harness these inner resources to weather the tumultuous sea ahead. In the spirit of humility, we can feel empowered by the visionary leaders of our past as we listen inward and to one another for answers to the difficult questions of our time. Let us rise to the honor of being the ancestors of the future, and let us do so for the sake of the beauty and innocence of our children, for the preservation of hope in the eyes of their children, and the precious magnificence of the natural world, and for every one of us, now and into the future.
Beautiful. Isabel St. Jean, thanks so much for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David, for this time with you.
I hope you enjoyed this chat with Isabel St. Jean. She recommended I use the anglicized pronunciation of her name, but Saint-Jean is probably closer. I think we can hear French-Canadian roots despite the fact that she now lives in Vancouver. After the call, she mentioned that she periodically comes down to this area and that our mutual friend Larry Robinson will probably host a local salon to acquaint people around here with her book, so I may get a chance to meet her in person. I'm very impressed by her writing. She doesn't set herself up as the newest personal growth guru. Rather, she speaks from the heart in a voice that is uniquely hers, both personal and authentic. She writes from a place of her own ethical imperative that has to do with using the second half of life to reclaim both one's authenticity and the planet. This is well captured in the title of her final chapter, Living Your Mission, Leaving Your Legacy. Let me close off this part of the podcast by reading a few paragraphs from this last chapter. She writes, "Those of us who have high expectations of ourselves may fear that our desire to make a significant difference is not fulfilled because we have not done enough. But contributions through actions, large or small, near or far, all have importance in the overall systemic functioning and betterment of our world. Consider, for example, how tiny organisms such as insects play their essential part in large interrelated ecological systems. If bees were to completely disappear off the face of the earth, we've been told, our continuity on the planet would be furthermore seriously threatened. Sometimes we believe we have not done enough because we underestimate to what extent our way of being can have a positive impact on others. Making a difference is also about expressing your caring through simple moments in which you support, encourage, or otherwise show your love toward others. Most of us never forget a person who is remarkably focused on possibilities and potential rather than obstacles and limitations. Around such a person, we often feel empowered and seen in our best light. Perhaps you too have come to realize that something particularly wise, kind, or insightful you've said has been etched in someone's heart memory. Clearly, in the end, our legacy emanates from the strength and clarity of our life themes, the choices we made, the actions we have taken, and the way we have related to others throughout our life. If your life's message emphasizes the importance of embodying love, being fair and just, having integrity, or displaying an indomitable spirit, you know that you will be remembered. And you may recall that Mother Teresa said, "We can only do small things with a lot of love," and that is the essence of creating a significant legacy. Albert Einstein reminded us of our interdependence and urged us to break out of the illusion that we are separate from others. I believe that becoming free of this illusion is part of the required curriculum while we are in the school of life on Earth. Close quote.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
I had a delightful face-to-face meeting last weekend with longtime listener Elaine. You recall from my comments last time that Elaine is the person who set up a seminar space for me in Second Life. In Second Life, her name is Marlena Polyatevska. At any rate, she was good enough to drive a couple of hours north from her home and meet me at a lunch spot in Petaluma. It so happens that she has a brother who lives in Petaluma. She wanted to conduct a brief interview with me for the FM radio station at which she has recently started working. The cafe where we met proved to be too noisy for the interview, so we ended up visiting her brother and conducting the interview there. I'm now kicking myself for not making at least a short recording of her, collecting 200th show congratulations at the very least. She has a very interesting story of her own, and she may want to share it on the show at some point. My other podcast series at wisecounselpodcast.com currently features an interview with Lacanian psychoanalyst Raul Moncayo. The Lacanian approach is quite challenging to understand at first. His answers in that interview are pitched at a pretty high level, probably most appropriate for other professionals in the field. Consequently, I'm planning to interview him again sometime down the line on Shrink Wrap Radio, and we're going to try to keep the discussion at a level a bit more understandable by the average layperson, so stay tuned for that. Tomorrow I return to teaching my Myth Dream Symbol class after having supposedly retired 3.5 years ago. I'm feeling a mix of excitement and apprehension. I always do. I know that there will be 25 new faces, new names to learn, new sets of expectations to satisfy, etc. I'm planning to play quite a few of the Shrinkwrap radio interviews on dreaming and archetypes and mythology in the actual class sessions, and I'm hoping the students won't find listening to audio in the classroom deadly dull. But hey, you folks find them educational, and it's a way for me to bring virtual guests into the classroom, virtual guests who are the tops in the field. And of course, I'm hoping that the audio interviews will provide good fodder for classroom discussion. Wish me luck. By the way, speaking of educational resources, let me remind you that there is a typed transcript of nearly all 190-plus interviews on Shrinkwrap Radio. I'm finding those transcripts very useful to help me review the content for which interviews I want to use in my class. I'm hoping that you're making good use of the transcripts as well. And once again, I want to thank all the volunteers out there who have made these transcripts available for us. What a gift. This is Shrinkwrap Radio number 192, which means that the milestone of number 200 is coming up very soon. Please send audio congratulations that I can play on the show using my voicemail on Skype, where my name is ShrinkPod, or the MyChingo button, or our phone at 206-337-0622, or by sending me a MP3 file via email. I want to thank all of you who have used the donations link on our website at Shrinkwrap Radio. Those cash donations mean a lot. I had hoped to move the show to a financial model that would depend entirely upon donations and to spare you from affiliate advertising. However, I would need to receive $500 a month to feel good about that decision. $500 a month seemed like a reasonable goal, inasmuch as it would require only 50 people to commit to $10 a month, or 100 people at $5 a month, plus various random amounts. With more than 1,000 subscribers and perhaps 4 times that many listeners, I thought $500 a month might be a reasonable goal. This month of January has seen $170 in donations. Now, please don't think I'm not grateful for those, because I am. At the same time, I think I'll need to go to a mixed model of affiliate advertising and donations. Neither one seems quite enough on its own at this point. The affiliate spots are pretty minimal, and your patronage of those sponsors in the past has helped to support the show as well. Or you can change my mind by heading to Shrinkwrap Radio right now and clicking on that big green donate button. Now, speaking of affiliate advertising, I put up a second Animoto Christmas video that I created. It's so easy, it probably took me all of 10 or 15 minutes to create. My sister used to work in Hollywood, and she said they used to have to use cameras on big booms to create moving videos from stills like this, and it would take a long time and a lot of money. Now the technology makes it so simple. You can see my latest effort under the Promos tab at Shrinkwrap Radio, and if you decide to sign up with Animoto at their $30 per year rate, be sure to do it from the link on the Shrinkwrap Radio site.
Hi, this is Gary Goodwin from Alexandria, Virginia, at the International Association for the Study of Dreams Conference. Wake up from your dream with Dr. Dave.
Hey, Gary, thanks for that. I hope you're still out there listening. Well, I'm running long here, so I'll just read a couple of recent emails. First, we hear from Jurian, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Please let me start with why I'm writing. The reason why I'm writing is because I find psychology interesting too, and I love the interview with the psychological roots of leadership. I'm 17 years old, and I'm from the Netherlands. English isn't my native language. I hope the mistakes aren't annoying, and maybe you could ignore them." Well, so far I haven't really caught any. "I'm very interested in psychology and the First World War. Because of that, I'm doing as my final assignment the subject Psychology of the First World War. I would like to thank you for this excellent interview, and it provided me with great, evidence at some points. Next year, I hope to study a new psychology study in Holland, an easier psychology study for my level, and after that, I will go to the university and study psychology. I got here thanks to your Zodiac letters on YouTube. I love those episodes, one more interesting than the other. Same goes for this site, one interesting article after the other. I will come back here more often. I would like to thank you for your time spent here and your interviews. Is there also something like you sometimes see on TV, a help desk for helping people, as I'm interested in hearing how to take care of people's problems? Or is there a link to a free radio talk where interviews and or other stuff just come along so I can listen to it while I'm busy? Thank you very much again, and I'm looking forward to your reply. Sincerely, Jurian. And he writes, P.S., your site has been planted in my favorites folder. Hey, very good. Thank you, Jurian. I'm pleased that you found your way to Shrink Wrap Radio by way of my YouTube videos. That was the whole reason for doing the YouTube videos in the first place. And I don't think they brought in as many people into Shrink Wrap as I had hoped. Nevertheless, they made me a bit of a star along with the book in the world of Zodiac aficionados. In fact, there was an event in San Francisco just a few weeks ago to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the murders. I was asked to officiate, and I could tell the audience had some affection for me and my various presentations. I ran out of energy for continuing the YouTube series, though, but perhaps I should. Now, I'm not entirely sure what you're asking for, Jurian, at the end of your email. Perhaps a call-in type show where people present their problems for advice. I didn't want to do that on Shrink Wrap Radio, but I have a friend who I've interviewed here, Suzanne Maiden, who's doing something a little bit like that. It's a podcast called Dear Zanny, and you and other listeners can find that on iTunes. Jurian, I also want to thank you again for putting yourself on our Frapper map and also for your recent generous donation, and that from a 17-year-old kid. I'm impressed and very appreciative. I also received an email from longtime listener Jack McShay, who thought other listeners interested in lucid dreaming might appreciate a link to a website that talks about how to cultivate lucid dreaming. And that link is wikihow.com/lucid-dream. Thanks, Jack, for that feature. A good place for you to place these links, since they're a little awkward to read out over the air, would be in the comments area of a given show. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype for ShrinkPod. You can leave voice messages using my Chingo or on our phone, which is 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Isabel St. Jean, for sharing her insights on living forward and giving back. Next week's show will feature a return appearance by Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, who will be speaking about her very eclectic approach to holistic psychotherapy. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.